WNST, Towson Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We got some Baltimore Positive stories this week. Don Mahler, former Baltimore County executive, is riding shotgun here for this portion of... And Don, I want to give you some oxygen on this because you were my high school guidance counselor in 1982 to set up Education Week here on the back of Arts Week. We're going to get to know some of the mayor candidates next week. I know we want to give some love to State Fair as well as Fadley's, where I'm getting to this week, and Mahler and Gary. But for Education Week, this has been pretty good stuff, hasn't it?
Oh, it's been terrific, and you know, it's been inspirational to talk to leaders of higher education throughout the state. And this morning, we're very excited because we're talking with the gentleman that really oversees the entire University of Maryland system, in Dr. Jay Perman. Jay, welcome, and thanks for joining us at Baltimore Positive.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, you know, at this point, we're trying to reach out to everyone, and clearly, we all thought we had crisis management somewhere in our golf bag, and then this comes up. You've been in some high pressure situations as a doctor and an educator over these years. But a little recap of these 7 weeks, and from where you were at the beginning of this to where we are right now, and trying to oversee tens of thousands of students, not to mention educators and everyone in the system. That's in a little bit of a state of we're all learning as we're flying the plane, aren't we?
Yes, and you're right. We've had to pivot quickly from the way we educate, the way we do research, often on campuses, usually on campuses, but mind you, having used online for some of what we do. And now, with the current situation and mindful of the safety of our students, the safety of our employees, we've had to move very quickly to completely distant learning. The only research that is going on our campuses, because we do both education and research, is largely related to the COVID-19 epidemic. So we have moved very quickly to distance learning, and now we're trying to think through the balance of the summer and being mindful of all kinds of possibilities for the fall. We're busy planning.
Well, you know, Dr. Perman, you bring so many hats to this discussion, which is why it's really great to have you. One of the things someone asked me the other day, and I said, you know, I don't have a clue, but we've got some folks coming on to do, and that is, as you look to whether you go back in the fall or not, and I know you put together, we'll have you talk a little bit about the advisory group that you put together, but one of the questions somebody asked me was, now, what's the current state of health care, and how do campuses deliver health care anymore? They knew what it was 30, 40 years ago when they were in college, but they were curious, what does health care look like in the University of Maryland system for students?
Well, we certainly have student health across the system, but student health obviously is not designed to deal with a pandemic. And were we to encounter students who need acute health care of a kind that is not the usual outpatient type health care that one might encounter anywhere, I mean, we would need to rely on the health system just like anybody else in the general public. But having said that, we do have student health services on campus, just like you and I did in the old days.
Dr. Perman, we've talked to so many folks about remote learning and the challenges and beginning the ramp up for this many, many years. I mean, there's been online colleges as long as there's been a century here, right? But when everyone gets disconnected, and we talked to some county superintendent and Dr. Darrell Williams last week, as well as Dr. Sonia Santelises in the city, just how many children and I guess college-age young people that would go home and not have the bandwidth or the speed or the Wi-Fi or the resources necessary for some folks just chewing off enough to go to college is all they have. The remote part of this and how we've wired America, and certainly for kids that don't live in urban environments where maybe the Wi-Fi speed isn't where it needs to be on various places, even in our state on the Eastern Shore and Western Maryland, we've heard this to be as much of a challenge as anything, not just for the children, but also for the teachers and the educators who may or may not have bandwidth at their home.
Well, I'm glad you brought this up, Nestor, because it's very easy for any of us to say, oh, no problem.
Yeah, I got Wi-Fi.
We're going to do distant learning. And of course, and I'm proud of our institutional leaders, it was quickly appreciated that this is not for everybody, that there are those who cannot afford it, who don't have the electronic equipment, who don't have access to the internet, and then there are people who live in places where you can't get it. So we have been very sensitive to that, and I'm very proud of our institutions. They have provided the resources to the extent that they can. A lot of it has been with donations, which again, we're very proud of and appreciative of, so that people that don't have equipment can have it. And I know that one of our campuses in a non-urban environment set up a hotspot in a parking garage, so that those that needed to connect could at least have a central place to do so while maintaining social distancing.
The challenge is, I looked, and you had obviously been very successful at the University of Maryland Baltimore and all of its professional schools. And then in January, you become the chancellor of the University System of Maryland. My guess is that when you took the job in January and you had your to-do list, pandemic wasn't on the list.
How about that? And you know, when I want to be cute, and it's probably wearing thin, I usually say to people that I thought I was going to higher education and leaving, for the most part, healthcare. Not that I wanted to, but I thought I was going to higher education. Look how they fooled me.
Yeah, they knew what they were doing. All of the decisions that you have to make. Another question that I got in, and Dr. Perman, maybe this is a segue into the advisory group that you put together. I know you have 9 grandchildren varying age. I've said to some of the other college presidents, you know, I have a senior in high school who hopes that she's on her way to Roanoke in August or September. She's not sure. You have thousands of students in that same boat. One of the questions that a mom asked me the other day was, you know, if my son or daughter is nervous about returning in September because of COVID and not sure where they want to be on a campus, if they decide to take that famous, what we call, I guess now, gap year, would their spot in that university or college be maintained for the following year? And I had no clue. Is that an issue?
Well, the other thing is, could I stay home and just wire into my classes and, hey, I like it this way, right? That's another way to do it.
Well, I'm going to disappoint you and that mom and the people in your family, because I don't know the answer to that.
Right.
And that is one of the issues that we are going to raise as we utilize this work group of experts drawn from our campuses. We've got to think through a lot of scenarios, and you two have just raised a couple of them, and that's on the list.
For you, go ahead.
I'm going to say to the doctor, Dr. Perman, tell our listeners, and again, if you're just joining us, we have Dr. Jay Perman, Chancellor of the University System of Maryland. You have recently announced this work group, advisory group. Talk a little bit about the composition of the group and what kind of guidance you've charged them with coming back to you with.
Well, what we've put together are people who are expert on the academic side, expert with regard to how you pay for it, expert with regard to how we use facilities, our enrollment management, public health, healthcare, people, and of course, student life. And what we're going to do, mind you, we have 12 universities, all different, one from the other, and also 3 regional higher education centers in Maryland. What we want to do is collect what they are planning on each campus, find the best practices, make sure that everybody is thinking about all the issues, and react to their plans, help them with their plans. But I can tell you, one campus is going to be different from the other. There are going to be some standard approaches, and there are going to be some unique approaches.
Dr. Perman, we've talked so much about medicine. I think we've all gotten our PhD now in epidemiology, right? I mean, I just go to the internet. You could find that out. From your background and all that you've studied, all that you've known, we talk about pandemics and there not being a leadership playbook for pandemics for universities. For you as a medical man, as a science man, as someone that understands this at a far higher level than I would, just from your studies and your experience, give me a little thought about pandemics and where it was in your mind as someone who worked in hospitals and heard about this sort of boogeyman that maybe one day could be the new polio or the thing that has literally our entire economy shut down. I would think in all of your experience, it's not something you put a lot of thought into, but when you heard, you know, Wuhan, coronavirus, January, February, some thoughts about what goes through your mind as a doctor.
Well, I appreciate the question, Nestor. You know, pandemics, that's something that occurs elsewhere, not in the United States of America. I think that's the way we all got raised, and as a matter of fact, there are people in medical education right now who are saying, how come we didn't learn? How come we weren't taught, we as healthcare providers, how come we weren't taught in the course of our education to deal with pandemics? But again, it was something that was taught as a public health epidemiology course, but not something that we would need to engage in ourselves. I'm very proud of the way the healthcare professions have stepped up to the plate. They're saving us all. But I would say, in answer to your question, it's not that we were especially trained for this, except for those who have been very much involved in global health, which happens to be a strength at my former institution, which is part of our system, the University of Maryland, Baltimore. I think going forward that, yes, we're all hoping, waiting for a vaccine at the quickest moment possible. But the other thing that I think encourages me and I would share with you is the fact that we're not standing still just waiting for a vaccine. We are engaged in biomedical research, looking for treatments of those who are infected, other approaches that might result in quicker protection than the classic vaccine. Frankly, I am not Pollyannish, but I am optimistic that biomedical research will save us again.
Doctor, my wife's a two-time leukemia survivor, and over at Johns Hopkins in 14 and 15, had two bone marrow transplants. So, you know, 155 nights in the hospital, I was wearing as many gloves and masks as you during that period of time, right? And we learned about germs and bacteria and viruses and things that could kill her when she was neutropenic. And, and I think about what societies had to all learn in the 5 minutes that my wife and I did when they handed us a box of masks and said, you might want to bone up on what leukemia is. You know, as a sports guy, I only knew about it from a movie that was made 40 years ago, right? So you start to learn, and I think as society starts to learn about this, the one thing that I would say for you in being a part of medical institutions, PPE and ventilators, and thoughts about, was there ever a point where those kinds of thoughts would have entered your mind in running medical, that you would have a shortage of that? I can't begin to think of how much Purell I used at every hospital door, and every doctor used in and out of every hospital room my wife was in, not to mention how many masks, rubber suits, rubber gloves that I went through the period of time, and never thinking about where they came from or who paid for them, or they were just outside the door, and they were just there, and they appeared. And I really started to think about 6 weeks ago about what it was like when I saw New Yorkers using New York Yankees raincoats as PPE. You know, it was kind of frightening.
Well, you know, we are all comfortable as healthcare providers with what we call precautions, isolation precautions. We all, as you point out, know about putting on a gown and putting on a mask, and being careful about not spreading infection and not bringing infection to a compromised patient. That's what you learned. What we have not before encountered is doing this on a mass scale. And again, it comes back to what I said earlier. Epidemics, pandemics usually occur somewhere else. Now it's upon us.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Dr. Perman. You mentioned the training and a lot of your colleagues and the docs looking at one another and go, whoa, you know, I don't know that I was ready for this. Putting your old hat back on, because it wasn't that many months ago that you were in charge of the University of Maryland, Baltimore, and the med school, would you anticipate that as a result of this going forward, that medical schools across the country will have some additional focus on these kinds of killer viruses that they did not have in the past?
I don't think there's any question about it. I do think that we realize that with regard to what I learned as a medical student and what we teach medical students, we didn't quite teach this. I think, you know, experience is always a great stimulus to making change where you need to. And so the answer to your question is yes, absolutely.
And it appears to be so complicated. Someone had sent me yesterday an interview with a Dr. David Katz, I think it's from Yale, who did an interview with Bill Maher the other night. He's written a number of articles. And he really focused on the complex nature of the virus in terms of whether it's total isolation, the other extreme, which people that want you to jump back in the pool right away, or somewhere in the middle where you recognize that the healthy among us may indeed have to get this in larger numbers if we're really to come out on the other side. Have you given that issue much thought, given that there's 145,000 or so students getting ready to come back to campus?
Well, there's a lot of controversy about this, isn't there? This is what we call herd immunity. You know, in the old days, maybe you remember this, Don and Nestor. In the old days when we didn't have vaccines for so many of the childhood illnesses that we have now, I mean, our parents used to have, what did they call them, chicken pox parties, measles parties. You know, let's get everybody exposed and let's just get over it or get it over. And that's the same concept here. Is it wise with such a threatening virus? Probably not. But as you know, a number of European countries are taking that approach. Let's just get it over with, get people exposed. There are going to be a number of deaths. You know, there are ethical issues here. And there are scientific issues here. So this is a controversial area.
It's really, really, really challenging. I'm curious, Doc, what, you and I chatted briefly off the air before we came on. When you look back at your career and your journey, I mean, you're a well-respected pediatrician as well as an administrator. What skill set and what values and just total, I guess, ethos of being a pediatrician has served you well in these leadership roles that you've had? What do you bring as a pediatrician to these jobs?
Well, you know, people often ask me, students often ask me, why'd you become a pediatrician? And what I usually say is that I happen to value children in ways that we don't necessarily see ourselves as adults. And what do I mean by that? Children are incredibly honest. What you see is what you get. They tell you what's on their mind, and they expect that of you. They expect that of their caregivers. They expect that of their pediatrician. So being direct, transparent, honest, say it like it is, tell us what you're thinking. I find that goes very well in administrative roles too.
Dr. Jay Pearman joining us here. He's the chancellor at the USM, the University System of Maryland, beginning earlier this year. And, of course, a longtime pediatric gastro, and I can barely say it, and served as the president of the University of Maryland in Baltimore here. You know, we're Baltimore positive, and I think no better person to have on than you to talk about, you know, we have an election coming up, we have leadership issues, we have COVID going on, all of this. You have been involved in Baltimore and trying to make Baltimore better for a long, long time. Some thoughts about where we are in the journey and how this thing's going to change us on the other side of this. It's our ongoing conversation, Doctor, that we talk about all the time when we're not talking to educators and or people in the medical space, everyone, in trying to pick Baltimore up. I know you've done a lot of things in the West Baltimore area, community engagement centers, and being involved in a lot of ways to try to your point, lift the children up, right? And then we can lift our community up.
So let's focus on the children, and I'm glad you said that. Look, there are a lot of needs in Baltimore. We all know that. But we have to play the long game. I'm not saying that there aren't acute issues that need attention, but we cannot forget about the long game. If we can get our Baltimore children a good education, opportunity to see careers that they can engage in, that we need them in, hope. That's what our children need in Baltimore. Hope, a better life, a career, an income. We can't let go of that. We have to do everything we can in order to give them those opportunities. And that's why in West Baltimore, UMB has been so intentional about exposing students to healthcare careers and to the fact that they can succeed, they can have a healthcare career. We need them in healthcare because we need much more diversity in healthcare, and it's a jobs program. There are always jobs in healthcare. That's why we focused on the CURE program in West Baltimore so that we can take kids starting in the sixth grade, get them excited about healthcare, get them prepared in STEM, and give them a better future. The payoff's a long time down the line, but you got to start somewhere.
You know, I hear your voice in Chicago, and it makes me want deep dish pizza, you know. And for anyone who doesn't have a Baltimore accent that winds up settling here, I want to give you some oxygen to talk about how, you know, why you're here. You know, like, what you obviously love Baltimore. I love it for different reasons because I was born 4 miles from here and never left, right? But you've lived other places. What is it about Baltimore that makes you want to save Baltimore?
Well, Nestor, you've picked up my Chicago accent. One never loses that, even though I left Chicago in 1977, which is a long time ago. Look, I have had a great career, which started in San Francisco, and I came to Baltimore from San Francisco. And truth be known, I've left Baltimore a few times in taking jobs elsewhere. But here's the point. This is the third time I've come back. That says something about how I and my family feel about Baltimore. And again, I'm going to bring it back to kids. We've got a lot of challenges for kids here, but I tell everybody that I try to recruit here, Baltimore is a great place to raise a kid.
I'll talk about that piece, and you've been gracious with your time, and we're going to let you go momentarily, but I have a couple of quick things. One, you just mentioned recruitment. We've heard periodically from other business executives. We've actually heard from hospital officials. We did a whole segment with Hospital Association of Maryland, and they're concerned that Baltimore's image, as it's become with the homicide rate and others, has made it increasingly difficult for them to recruit. Do you sense that? Did you sense that on the medical side of the equation when you were in that role?
You know, I really didn't, and I don't want to appear to have my head in the sand because I just said a few minutes ago, Baltimore has incredibly challenging problems that we all need to collectively put our shoulder to. Having said that, maybe it's because a lot of my recruitment has been in the helping professions. In other words, the healthcare segment, the legal segment, social work. For God's sakes, these are people who run two problems. That's the nature of these professions. So I respect what people are saying, but it has not daunted me.
And finally, I guess I would ask, Nestor, I'd ask the doctor, can you sort of explain to folks who are listening, driving in their cars, the role of the chancellor, you've got 12 colleges and universities. You've got, they all have presidents. What's the structure? I mean, the presidents have, you know, certainly vision and mission for their colleges. How do you all work together? What's the role of you overseeing the entire system?
Well, it's never been more apparent than in this time where we're dealing with a crisis together. We have our own individual institutions. The presidents run their institution, but the system and the chancellor sort of express something that many of you may remember in an old book from about 30 years ago by Robert Fulghum, Everything I Really Needed to Know, I Learned in Kindergarten. Well, in the preface to that book, the last principle that he articulates is when you go out into the world, it's best to hold hands and stick together. And that's never been more true than it is now in higher education, not just with regard to the pandemic, but with regard to so many issues that higher education faces in meeting its responsibilities to society. It's good to hold hands and stick together. So I'm the person that encourages people to do that.
Dr. Perman, we really enjoyed the visit with you. We know your time's busy, and you got a million things going on trying to get all these students and all these presidents and all these facilities back in order, and we certainly are pulling for you and with you, and we're going to put our shoulders into all the things that you got your shoulder into. Really appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you, Nestor and Don. Thank you so much.
Dr. Jay Perman, the fifth chancellor at the USMA. I just think he just summed up exactly what they're doing there and putting 12 institutions of higher learning together. And Chancellor Dr. Jay Perman sits at the top of that after serving as a pediatric gastroenterologist. There, I knew I'd get to say it. If I get to say it, maybe I get the degree. I'm not sure. You can find me anytime, any place, out on the internet. We're mixing and mingling the WNST family brand along with the Baltimore Positive brand. We have all sorts of things we're doing with Arts Week, mayoral candidates, and education, and as well as hospitals and local medical institutions during COVID. I am Nestor. We are WNST.net, AM 1570, and WNST, keeping calm, staying local. And Dr. Perman will like that I broke out the Sporticulture Terps Magma lamp here at WNST.